People love horses. More than 2 million Americans own a horse. Plenty more visit stables, get riding lessons, or live vicariously through the heroes in books like Black Beauty or National Velvet. Why do people love, and I mean really love, our equine friends? Sarah Maslin Neer is a reporter for the New York Times and the author of Horse Crazy, the story of a woman and a world in love with an animal. Sarah, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
So what does the title mean, horse crazy? Is that a phrase you've heard throughout your life?
It is absolutely a phrase I've heard. And I should tell you, I'm standing on a horse farm right now. So if you hear some ambient horse noises like clip-clops, whinnies, or maybe a tractor or two, it's because I'm in my element, because I'm horse crazy.
Oh, that's wonderful. You say the book is about obsession as a general concept, but you tell the story through your own specific obsession with horses. Explain that connection you have.
Well, it's interesting. As an investigative reporter for The Times, we really have the word I beaten out of us. It's, the story is never about me. And when I first pitched this book, it was a compendium of stories of obsession with horses, because wherever I've gone as a Times reporter around the world, when I put away my notebook officially, I whip out another and I go try to find the horses. And then I got some response from my editors who said, you know, it isn't the story of horses around the world. It's the story of horses through you. And I turned the lens on myself to try to understand that. Why have I been compelled by these creatures since I'm 2 years old? The answer to me and any dyed-in-the-wool horse girl is because horses. That's just something we don't question. But I sought to unpack it in this book, and it became a personal journey through horses and people obsessed just like me.
I mean, how do you explain the emotional connection you have for people who haven't spent a lot of time around them or maybe a little afraid? Because these are big, powerful animals.
Mm-hmm. There are a bunch of different theories. The rocking, the syncopation of a horse's stride replicates that feeling we all had the first 9 months of our lives in the womb, of floating and swaying in amniotic fluid. When else as an adult are you rocked? And so it's a very compelling, centering feeling. Another one is about power, that on my own two legs, I'm just Sarah, but lent for more, I'm formidable. I can access power and freedom that is out of the reach of a mere mortal, but combined with a horse, it's far more. But that didn't really seem to get at the heart of it. That's a little too clinical. And I thought about when you look at a dog or a cat, they're charming, right? You have an adorable ooh emotion reacting to them. But a horse makes you feel something, much like an ocean vista or a view from a mountain. And I really sought to understand that. And the answer is myriad. I could speak to you for a whole lifetime about that answer.
Well, it's clear I can hear the passion in your voice as you're talking about horses. And it's interesting, you talk about how horses have followed you through your life and career. What do you mean by that?
Well, I have a very unusual upbringing for a horse girl. I'm born and raised in New York City. I'm the daughter of a Holocaust survivor and an immigrant. And horses didn't seem like my world to me. There was some subtle messaging that this was an elite world, that someone waspier, someone who didn't bring kosher lunch meat on school trips was allowed to participate in. And actually that sort of Americanized world of horses was created by Ralph Lauren, you know, the Cashmere and the Jodhpurs. And my father would always say, not Ralph Lauren, Ralphie Lipschitz. You know, that's Ralph Lauren's real name. He's a Jewish boy chick from Queens. And those messages that this elite world tried to suffuse me with, I fought against. And I tried to have horses by hook or by crook. I was a mounted parks enforcement officer chasing truants, much like myself, in Central Park. I taught riding lessons with the founder of the New York City Black Rodeo in Harlem. And I've chased down the horses, and they've returned the favor and always stayed present in my life.
We're speaking with New York Times reporter Sarah Maslin Neer about her book, Horse Crazy. And we want to hear from you. Are you horse crazy too? Tweet us at 1A, leave us a message on our Facebook page, or drop us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and from our guests. Maybe we'll hear a horse in the background too in just a moment.
We'll be right back.
Let's get back to horses with New York Times reporter Sarah Maslanier. Her new book is called Horse Crazy, the story of a woman and a world in love with an animal. You know, Sarah, going back to that question of explaining this love to non-horse people, there is definitely an accessibility factor at play here. I mean, the horse world is very exclusive, very expensive. Why is that?
What I say in response to that is that the horse world is exclusive, but horses are not. Horses are deeply democratic. And I interviewed the famous horse whisperer, Monty Roberts, and he said the sole need of a horse, what it asks of a human, is, are you a safe place to be? That's its only requirement. And I have really looked at that principle in understanding the horse world itself. Horses are incognizant of the wealth that surrounds them. And it's a little bit of an error. In the American West, horses are far more accessible, but there are invisible lines braided throughout this culture. One of my explorations in the book is into the black cowboys. One in four cowboys in the pioneer era, one in four, were black. And have you ever seen a black cowboy in a silver screen under a Stetson? That's because the people who wrote those movies and those stories about American identity were white. And so horses are far more an accessible world than they've been presented to be. One other amazing factoid is the winner of the first ever Kentucky Derby was a black man, and the trainer was a freed slave of that horse.
Is there a concerted effort by the horse world to make things more inclusive?
There is a conversation that's been happening in parallel with the wider conversation of Black Lives Matter to understand what has led to this situation where, especially in the hunter-jumper, show-jumping world, it's exclusively white, almost exclusively. And there are conversations happening now that are really beautiful and making it grow. But it can't just be about the money. It's about the messaging. And when you hear that Black people have been erased from the American equestrian origin narrative, the thing that we all think of our wild and free spirit riding across the American landscape, and people were removed from it, you can understand that the work has to be done to rewrite that story where it should be, and it has to be hard work.
Well, we heard from Meg in Boyce, Virginia. She's a farrier, meaning she's the person who fits shoes onto horses.
I think my favorite thing about being a farrier is the community that we all have together, how we all are able to work together, all of my colleagues, to help each other out if something happens to one of us. You know, somebody's sick, somebody needs to take a leave of absence. Since we're all self-employed, we kind of have to watch out for each other. And also just the clients and dealing with the different horses, whether they're competing at a really high level or they're someone's pet. You know, there's so many different people who you get to see and interact with on a daily basis. And every day is different, and every hour of every day is different. It's never boring. You can wake up one morning thinking you're going to have one day, and it's going to turn into something completely different.
You know, Sarah, to a lot of us, the horse world seems very glamorous. You have the Kentucky Derby, those outfits and hats, but then there are people like Meg who are working and living in that world. Do you see that distinction in your life? Are there two different horse worlds?
I think there are 1,000 different horse worlds, and the book delves into numerous ones, internationally, from people like Meg making it happen for horses to show jumpers like Georgina Bloomberg, Mayor Bloomberg of New York City's daughter, who travel around the world on private jets with their horses. I tried to dig into all those worlds. So, for example, I have a Dutch Warmblood. It's a Dutch horse. His name's Trendy. He's fat as a house, and I love him to death. And I just thought to myself, how do I have a Dutch horse outside of New York City? And I tried to pull that thread with my reporting. So I ended up in the belly of a cargo hold of a 747 importing 9 Dutch Warmbloods, being essentially a stewardess for these horses throughout their journey to America. And I dug for horses everywhere. There are wild horses that swim across the Assateague Channel in Virginia. And those ponies draw so many people it's not that an exclusive world there. There were two young sisters who had purchased one of these wild ponies at auction, only to set her free to be a wild horse forever. So there are many different ways to be horse crazy.
We're talking to New York Times reporter Sarah Maslin Neer. Her new book is called Horse Crazy, The Story of a Woman and a World in Love with an Animal. We're also hearing from you. Laura tweeted, when you're working with horses, they demand your full attention, in part because of their size. It makes it very easy to get out of your own troubles, anxieties, worries of the world, if only for an hour. We also heard from Devin, who says, I love riding horses and being around them, but it occurred to me a few years ago, if they had a choice, would they want to be running around with us on their backs? Sarah, what do you think?
That's something I really explore deeply in the book. There are many ways to have a horse in your life, and there are many ways to do a cruelty to a horse in your life. And some people have a vision of riding as a dance between two partners who enjoy it in the same exact way. I'm about to get a farm tractor going past me, just FYI, a little farm noise for you. And I don't believe that's what it is. I believe that it is a conversation between a creature bred for a millennia to be a perfect complement to humankind. And those are the type of engagements that we have with horses. And it is very important as the predator, essentially, in the predator-prey relationship, to recognize that it is easy to do a cruelty to a horse and to respect them enough to make sure you never do.
As you were coming up as a horse girl, how did you learn about that distinction?
I failed at that distinction. I rode with a very prominent trainer who's the son of a celebrity show jumper growing up. And being this immigrant child, feeling like an interloper in this world, I didn't question what I was told to do. And I write in the book that I would remove the water bucket from my horse's stall the night before a competition at this man's instruction to keep her subdued. And I look back at that and I think, I prevented a horse from slaking its thirst for 24 hours of trying its heart out for me. And it really is a shock that that excuse I was just following orders really is never good enough. And I've made it the project of my life to be a better horsewoman and a better person.
How did you come out of that? Because when we learn those types of lessons from very young, it can be very difficult to shake free from them.
Yeah, I unpack a lot of myself in the book, and I try to understand why I was so compelled, why I felt like such an outsider in this world, and how I broke free of it. And one of the things that I realized, again, is that horses didn't know I didn't belong. They didn't care. They only wanted me to be their safe place to be. And in freeing myself from the strictures of feeling an outsider and that I didn't deserve to have my perspective heard and my way done with horses, I changed, and I read up and I educated myself, and I essentially reported my way to being a better horsewoman.
Well, you're in New Jersey now, literally riding out the pandemic, but you're from New York City and you contracted the coronavirus a few months ago. How have things been?
Yeah. Oh, I haven't left New York City. I'm just here to play with the horses. I go right back. I won't betray my hometown. She's my girl. I contracted coronavirus because essentially the night the second case was made public in New York City, the second case in the state, I drove straight to the epicenter of the disease on March 3rd. And it was before we as a country knew the full parameters. So when I arrived in New Rochelle to investigate this, I was opening doors with my hand. By the end of the week, I was opening them with my elbow. And by then, it was too late for me. And horses really healed me from that. I was 24 days confined to my apartment. My iPhone told me I took 52 steps a week because I couldn't get out of bed. And I kept thinking, I have to get well to be with these animals. And when I did, I actually drove to a barn in Queens, which there are many more horses than you'd think in New York City. This is a therapeutic riding organization I'm on the board of called Gallop NYC. And I just sat in front of the horses like a person who had been shipwrecked touching dry land. And that's what they do for my soul and the souls of so many other people.
As I was reading the book, there are a number of incidents where you're injured or you fall. You have this very vivid description of falling off a horse when you were a very young girl. And, you know, all of the adults being completely terrorized around you because the horse was coming towards you. Mm-hmm. But you coming up from that fall and just being like, good horsey. and that's not, but that's not the first time you fell. How have you continued to overcome the fear that could very easily set in after a fall?
Sure. So that incident you're speaking of is when I was 2 years old, my first time cantering. I shouldn't have been cantering, but I was sure I knew how to be a cowgirl. And I fell and the horse came back around and actually jumped over me. And somehow that imprinted in my mind, wrongly or rightly, that horses would save me, and they always would. And in many ways in my life, they have saved me, both in spectacular accidents that I walked away unscathed from, and also in healing me when I was attacked by a robber who stabbed me in my New York City apartment. Horses became my solace. But I've broken vertebrae, and I've cracked my head, but it's an extreme sport, and I think because it's so predominantly female in this country, especially the show jumping world, sexism makes people think it's not as badass as rock climbing. But I'm extreme too. You know, I'll run into a burning building with my notebook out and straight to a kidnapping zone in West Africa because your passion makes it worth it.
Well, we got this email from Brenda who says, I grew up in Scotland and had no connection to horses. My husband and I immigrated to the U.S. in 1966 and have lived and raised a family here. As a child, I was always fascinated with horses. So for our 50th wedding anniversary, my husband and I spent a week at a guest ranch in Montana. We rode horses twice daily, and I just loved it. We also heard from Beth. That sounds wonderful, doesn't it?
Yeah, wow.
We also heard from Beth, who says, I was raised in the suburbs with no opportunity to ride horses. But at age 40, while watching my daughter in her riding lessons, I thought, why am I sitting here watching? I want to try. So here I am at 65 and just bought my own pony. It's been an experience of connecting with this wonderful animal, but also overcoming fear and challenging myself physically, mentally, and emotionally. Thanks for sharing those messages with us. Sarah, as you continue this relationship with horses, how does it continue to stretch you and make you learn more about yourself?
Well, in investigating the book, I looked into my own family's history. I think a part of me was still holding on and hoping I was authentically a horse person, right? One of those people who has their great aunt, a daguerreotype of her on astride a beautiful horse. And I looked in to my father had always told a story that we had a subversive cousin before World War I in Poland who would purchase he would collect the discarded horses that the Polish cavalry would leave in the woods, all broken, bent, and, you know, horribly mistreated. And then he'd bring them back to his farm, and he'd put a little pepper under their tail, and then call the Polish cavalry back and say, I've got these fresh, wild horses for you. And I wanted to see that horses were part of my family, and I researched that story, and it's a total crock. It's not true. I have no horses in my family. I'm just a horse nut. But that freed me. That made me realize that, you know, your identity is what you make of it, and your passion is your passion, and nobody needs to give you permission to have a passion. Those two women that you read, they're older women who stood on the sidelines of something they loved, and finally they let themselves have access. And I think that's beautiful.
We talked about cottagecore earlier in the hour, but there's another internet meme of the horse girl. Is that something you identify with?
You know, I don't buy the horse girl. Oh, we got another tractor zipping past us. Hey, guys. Nice to see you. Enjoy feeding the horses that hay. I don't buy it. The horse girl as a weirdo, sort of akin to, you know, a mathlete or something. And I don't buy that trope. The horse girls that I knew growing up were aspirational, you know, bite-sized Barbies. And that was an exclusive world, not one that was marginalized or something that would make you nerdy. And I think that horse girl trope is a little bit of self-consciousness of that world, trying to say, no, no, we're not on a pedestal. We're, you know, a step away from a cat lady. I don't buy it.
Well, as you know, on the other side of writing this book, as you think about where you are right now, I mean, as you think about maybe the next 5 or 10 years, what does your horse life look like?
What a good question. I never would have imagined that I would be reviewing spas, which is one of my freelance gigs as I made my way through journalism, and that would take me to ride a rare Indian Marwari horse with curlicue ears, and that in my researching the Indian Marwari and finding out that they can't be exported because... Oh, did you hear that horse?
Yes!
Finding out that they can't be exported because the Indian government considers them a rare creature would lead me to the edge of Cape Pogue Bay in Martha's Vineyard and meet a woman who had been smuggling their semen to America and creating an illicit herd of these rare Indian Marwaris on her island paradise, which I chronicle in the book. So I cannot possibly tell you the adventures that horses are going to give me. All I know is that they are a gift, and that when they let you sit astride them or just watch them in a field, they're a treasure and just an adventure with four legs.
That was New York Times reporter Sarah Maslin Neer. Her new book is called Horse Crazy, the story of a woman in a world in love with an animal. Sarah, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. The horses say thanks, too.
Remember to subscribe to the 1A podcast. It's where you'll find our best guests and stories every day. You can listen whenever you'd like, and you can get it wherever you find our podcasts. Today's producer was Arfi Getty. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again soon. This is 1A.